Good evening, everyone. My name is Joe, and we're delighted, you know, part of the committee, the Young Actors Program, to have you guys come tonight. I know it's a bit cold, but it's a good turnout, and I think it's going to be a great night. So today we have Peter Ellenson from NAB Wealth, who's going to be speaking about working overseas. He's going to share a couple experiences. So I'll just give a background about Peter. So Peter is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a fellow of the CPA, Australia. And he's worked overseas for about 10 years in three different continents and five different countries. You can ask him about the countries a bit later. And at the moment, he's actuarial controller at NAB Wealth, or MLC, used to be called MLC. In his current role, he's responsible for the delivery of actuarial aspects of the wealth function, including policy liabilities, reserves, capital calculations, experience studies, and company valuations. And prior to joining NAB Wealth, Peter worked in various CFO and actuarial roles in Australia, Asia, and South Africa and UK. Probably want to ask him why he worked in South Africa or how that all came about later. Yeah, I'm from South Africa as well. Stop laughing, eh? Well, it just goes to show how much, you know, opportunities out there, you know, in some of the developing countries. Just to give you a bit of stats, 2% of, you know, all the actuaries in the world are in Africa. Now, Africa is a big continent. It's not one country. It's about more than 50 countries. So if you do a supply and demand, obviously, there is a premium going to Africa, or used to be. Peter will explain. So I'm just going to show you quickly a clip which Peter might have taken when he was in South Africa, okay, if you don't mind.
I said tigers by accident, man. Of course I know how it is. It's like he's, I think he's got some kind of hair or something.
No, there's a horn. There's a horn.
I guess we're not here now.
And now we know the horns.
We'll never know. Look, they've been scared of our thing.
No, I think they're going to eat them.
No, they don't eat meat, they're vegetarian.
No, they're carnivores, everyone knows that.
No, but don't say everyone knows that. I don't believe it's true. I believe they're vegetarian.
No. That's why they're king of the jungle, they eat meat.
Well,
the king of the jungle doesn't eat meat.
No, but I do.
Look at
them. I do believe that they're vegetarian.
No, they eat meat. Oh, no, he doesn't see them. No, I think they're going to eat them. They eat wildebeest. They know they eat wildebeest.
Look, I'm looking.
He stopped.
Look.
Oh, it's a crocodile.
Yeah, it's a crocodile.
It's a crocodile. You said, remember you said there's no crocodiles. Look, there's crocodiles.
I didn't say there was no crocodiles. Look at that. Look. Oh, look.
Yeah, that's about it. Well, let's give a warm welcome for Peter and as he comes over.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, that's one of the things you can do when you travel overseas, and certainly I went on many safaris into many of the national parks in Kenya, Tanzania, Zimbabwe and South Africa and Namibia when I was there. Overseas travel is brilliant. Most of you may have been on holidays overseas. That's one aspect of fun. You're there for a couple of weeks, get to see a few sights, get to tick off, yep, seen the Eiffel Tower, seen Great Wall of China, etc. Living overseas is different than just travelling overseas. So don't expect just because you like travelling you're going to like living overseas. There are some brilliant aspects of living overseas and some not so brilliant aspects of living overseas. Hence my title, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. Probably not going to be any lightning bolt moments during tonight's presentation. I'm going to say, aha, I hadn't thought about that. There's a lot of common sense. A lot of things to think about when you make the decision to go overseas. So let's start with the good. Obviously, travel, to go and see things. Oh, let's just pop over, you know, we're living in Singapore or Hong Kong, pop over to Vietnam for a long weekend, or Cambodia. Go to the Philippines, go to Boracay for 4 days. I mean, how many people can do that from Australia? It's a bit hard. But when you're living over there, many opportunities to travel. We'll talk about airlines later, but travel, brilliant. We all love it. And you're going to have to love it if you want to go live overseas. Culture. Many of the things about culture, even culture here in Australia, and you appreciate people are different here in Australia, you sort of, as actuaries, you know, it's the other side of the brain that actuaries, but just to think about the culture. You don't need to have, again, aha or lightning bolt moments, but just to understand the culture. I mean, you're driving home or you're driven home in Indonesia, 3 o'clock in the morning, there's people on the side of the road playing chess against each other, neighbours playing chess on the side of the road. They've got nothing else to do. They're unemployed. It's hot. They're actually playing chess at 3 o'clock in the morning as a community. It's just fascinating to see that sort of thing. Financial rewards. Often it's the first thing you think about overseas, big overseas secondment, expat, car, driver, apartments, schooling for the children. Well, the financial rewards, used to be there a lot. I can tell stories of times when I was living in Hong Kong and living in $10,000 a month apartments and driving BMW 530 to work type thing. Financial rewards are there, perhaps not so much more. When you do think about travelling overseas or living overseas, the financial aspects are very important. You want to at least break even compared to your role here. So when you find out about financial, understand the tax consequences. The tax consequences of Australia, negative gearing as an expat doesn't work, for example. Understand your cost of housing overseas. Understand your cost of a car. To buy a car in Singapore is probably $100,000. Can you live without a car in Singapore? Taxis are cheap, but taxis won't take you to Malaysia to play golf. Taxis won't be there at 9 o'clock on a Friday night when you want to go from your post-dinner drinks to your restaurant, okay? Because it's their busy time. Just like catching a taxi in Sydney at 6 o'clock on a rainy Friday night. They're not there when you need them. So financial rewards, very important, but do your homework before you accept anything overseas. The other thing is, like any job, even if you're negotiating a job in Australia, you've got to do the hard yards first in your negotiation. People have short memories. So do your negotiations up front. Don't expect, in a year we'll give you a good pay rise. In a year we'll do that. Often doesn't happen. Times change. The most important, or potentially the most important, is interesting work. I work in life insurance. I've worked in life insurance for all of my life. Australia has a very large life insurance business, one of the largest in the world. But what do we sell? We sell YRT disability, we sell YRT lump sum, and we sell unit-linked products. Some of the more interesting aspects are for our traditional participating business or our annuity business, which are quite interesting. Overseas, you work in life insurance, you get a lot of exposure to other products, a lot of exposure to variable annuity products, a lot of exposure to health insurance products, which are called life insurance in many markets, a lot of exposure to different capital regimes, particularly if you're in a regional office, you might be dealing with 8 or 9 local offices, understanding the products in those offices, understanding the different regulatory environment that the policies are issued in, understand the different competitive environments, the different distribution, etc. Lots of interesting work overseas. Some brilliant experiences. Just, the work experiences, the social experiences, dealing with so many issues, dealing with the local telecoms companies to get your telephone working. So many great experiences. Just like travelling, just multiplied by about a factor of about 100. Because you've actually got to do things there. You just can't walk away. You've got to get your phone working. You've got to get your car registered. You've got to get your driver's license. You've got to meet interesting people. Okay? You meet so many interesting people. As expats, there's obviously a huge expat community in most countries, whether you're talking, Vietnam to Germany. Or even Australia, there's expat communities. But here, living in Australia as locals, we don't get to experience the expat side of it. You meet people. You meet people that have much different jobs than you. One interesting person I met, his job was to sell, airbags for airports. What this was, if you had a single runway at an airport and your plane ran off the runway, it's bogged. A plane is very heavy. His job was to go to these single runway airports and sell them airbags. Bags you put under the wings, fill them full of air, lift the aeroplane up so you can push it back onto the runway. That was his job. His sales target, 1 per year. But he got to travel to places in the middle of nowhere talking to the airport managers trying to say, what would you do in an emergency? You know, you're the airport manager at, you know, Boracay Airport or Langkawi Airport. You've got one runway, plane gets bogged, you know, your whole industry is shut down. No other plane can land there until something happens, and no plane can land there to give you the airbags after it's happened. Interesting people, interesting cultures, you know. You get to meet many Germans, you get to celebrate Oktoberfest, you get to celebrate Independence Day in the US, you get to celebrate the English Premier League, because you've got friends who are Swiss, German, Italian, as well as local friends. So, many, many good things. Probably nothing on that list is going to surprise you, though. You expect that. The more surprising things are perhaps on my second and third lists. The bad things. And there are bad things about working overseas. Settling in can be quite interesting. First few weeks, you're excited. It's new. It's different. It's just like travelling. But after that, you realise, oh, I can't buy Vegemite in the supermarket. Oh, I can't just, you know, these days you can't contact your friends easy. I just can't contact my friends easy. Oh, I don't know what happened on the cricket game or the football game. You miss things which you don't even think about. You miss, maybe you're in Singapore, 30 degrees every day. I miss the cold weather, okay? I miss winter. Very funny, but you do. You miss winter because it's the same temperature every day. You wear the same clothes every day. You don't get to try your new fashions, okay? Okay? The isolation, it is different. So the first 3 or 4 weeks, brilliant. You're on top of the world. Family, it can be unsettling for the family. Remember, if you have a family, you're taking your family there. Sometimes you're leaving your family behind. You know, maybe your mother and father might feel unsettled that you're living in Vietnam. They've only heard bad things about Vietnam. They don't know how wonderful it is. Your family can be unsettling. You know, you're working in the regional office. You're travelling, you know, every second week to a different country. They're trying to find schooling for your children. Your children come home from school and they're upset, etc. And you blame it all on the fact that, you know, you wanted to move to Hong Kong. It's your fault that my children can't settle into the school in Hong Kong. They were very happy back in Australia, for example. So it can be unsettling. You've got to be prepared for that. It's a risk. Quite a few stories of people moving overseas with their family. They're very happy in their job. They're travelling. They've got these great experiences we talked about, but the family is so unhappy that they have to turn around and come back to Australia. Remember, you've left your job in Australia. You're coming back to less than you had before you started. So if you're taking family, make sure you have those conversations with them. Missing Australian culture. You'd be surprised that you miss the Australian TV shows. You know, perhaps these days you can catch up with it on the internet, etc. I still find I don't mind a beer. I like going out for a beer and going to the bar and listening to music. They'll put on a song and half the place will start singing along to it or dancing to the song, and I won't know the song. I was out of the country for 10 years, and it was the most popular song in one of the years I was outside the country. I've missed it. I've missed that part of Australian culture. I've missed that song. It's not played on the radio anymore, but everyone knows the words to it, apart from me. You miss it. You miss the TV. You miss some of the sporting achievements. You miss your team you followed for 25 years, finally win their first premiership, and there's very few people there to celebrate with. So you can miss it. Working hours. One of the questions people always ask is about working hours. In Australia currently, we have a thing called work-life balance, which most employees sort of cherish. They think they have to cherish it to keep people interested. Working overseas, this sort of work-life balance doesn't quite exist as much. I must say, we had an expression where at one place we used to work, which is work hard, play hard. We used to work hard, 10, 12 hours a day, not a problem. We used to go out, restaurants, bars, boat rides, travelling, etc. Work hard, play hard. Didn't turn on the TV for a couple of years, didn't worry me. That's your lifestyle. And it was fun. So you've got to be prepared to work hard overseas, particularly if you want one of the ones on the earlier slide, the financial rewards. If you're going to be paid as an expat, get paid, you know, a good salary, get a housing allowance, maybe a car allowance, maybe education allowance, maybe driver allowance, maybe maid allowance, maybe pool boy allowance, maybe gardener allowance, electricity, gas, telephone. Of course they're paid for you. You're going to get paid for all that. You've got to work for it. So remember that. Nothing comes for free. Working hours can be draining. Your lifestyle can be draining. Remember to keep a balance there. But no problem. When you're young, work hard, play hard, and enjoy. Travel. Travel is brilliant. Business class airfares. Gold membership. I was going to bring my gold membership cards from Singapore Airlines and Cathay and Qantas. The old ones. I don't have them anymore because I'm here. But the travel is brilliant. You know, and you know, you're often travelling business class and it's very, very nice. You can work on the plane, you can sleep on the plane, etc. But the novelty does wear off. It wears off when you land at Singapore Airport and you say, excellent, and we're going to pull into gate number 6 and I know it's only this far to customs. Or, oh no, we're going to gate 62 and I've got to catch that silly train and it's a long walk. That's when you know you've sort of had enough of the travel. This is the business trip side of the travel. This is where you're flying off to Bangkok for 3 days or 2 days and flying back. So the novelty does wear off. It does take a few years, though. I'll give you that. So, this is an interesting one. The Great Divide, Resentment and Racism. Put it there together because often you can't really tell what the issue is. Particularly if you are there as an expat, you have staff who are paid local salary. Indonesia, I had staff paid $100 a month. In Indonesia, they went through a bit of a mini financial crisis when I was there, and we gave our staff, we didn't want to give them a pay rise because that was like structural and we have to give the pay rise forever. So we're giving our people 4 kilograms of rice, kilogram of sugar and a litre of cooking oil every fortnight on a Friday, being their holy day being Muslims. Okay? There's a huge divide between their lifestyle and your lifestyle. Sometimes the people appreciate it, sometimes they resent it, and sometimes they really hate you for it. And you've got to live with that, and you know, sometimes you can't tell. You might go into a shop in a country where they don't speak your language. They know they don't speak your language. You might be there with your goods, just wanting to pay, and a local walks up and they can speak the language, so they'll serve that person first. You feel offended by that. You don't know if that's racism. You don't know if it's just because they don't want to try and speak English. They don't know if they want to just try and communicate and sort of ring it up and point to the till and say, that's how much money you should pay. Okay, there is feelings. Again, it's a bit like the isolation. You don't really know what's going on all the time. You don't always know other people's motives. But there is a great divide between yourself and some of your staff at times and some of the people in the community at times. You don't mean it. You mean nothing by it. And to you, it's just the way it is. To them, they may or may not hold a grudge and their actions may not be that it's a grudge. It just may be, you know, something that happens absent-mindedly. Okay, they may be embarrassed to speak English, the shopkeeper, but that's why they'll serve the local, because they can speak Bahasa or Tagalog or Thai to them. Finding new jobs. Okay, we're over in Hong Kong. I've got a great job. Sometimes the job comes to an end. They have a restructure, you're made redundant. You now need to find a new job in Hong Kong. Or back in Australia. Very, very difficult. Okay? A lot of companies will obviously promote from within or find someone from their, you know, a European insurer or someone from Europe to come out to do their job. Very hard to find a new job. Okay, and you can feel trapped. Okay, I'm in Hong Kong. I've told my job's been made redundant. Bit of cost cutting, it happens. It's nothing to do with you. Don't take it personally. Redundancies happen. But you've got to find a new job. It can be very, very difficult. And it's a risk you run. Okay, now we start with the ugly. Everyone knows The Good, the Bad, the Ugly is a film, right? But anyway, the ugly. I've only got a few things of the ugly. I mean, I'm very positive about working overseas, but so don't take the bit that there's one good and then there's the bad and the ugly, so it's one versus two. Okay. Australian property. Australian property is very interesting. I don't know if anybody here being young actuaries, how many of you own properties? How many own properties? Okay, a few at the back. How do you feel about renting those properties out if they're currently your home? You want someone sleeping in your bedroom? You want a tenant kicking in your wall? You want the phone call at 6 o'clock in the morning in Hong Kong that your place is flooded because there's been a big rain in Sydney? No, okay? So you move overseas. One option, you sell your place. One option, you don't have a place. Option, you put the tenants in. The problem is, Australian property market, if you're overseas for 10 years as I was, can boom in those 10 years. You can miss out on that. So the person sitting next to you in the office who's got the same job as you now, invests in Australian property because it's their home. You're overseas having a great time, brilliant time, the travel, the lifestyle, the culture. You come back 10 years later, they've got their million-dollar house, you've got $100,000 in the bank because they got into the Australian property market at the right time. So it is a big investment, Australian property. Obviously, I should put, this is not financial advice. But it's one of the things you can miss out on. You've either got to put tenants in your property, which is not very palatable to a lot of people and can cause a lot of grief, or get out of the property market, which means you could be out of the property market for all the time you're overseas, which means you could miss out on the biggest Australian property boom ever. Career trajectory. Again, the person sitting next to you steps up, over 10 years and they get to here. You've taken a big jump. You've gone overseas. You're already up there for 10 years. And for 10 years, you're at that level, maybe even a bit higher. But you come back and you know all about direct sales force distribution. And you know all about selling single premium guaranteed bonds to the Chinese public. And you know all about the legislation in Taiwan and the negative spread issue in Taiwan. You know all about US GAAP and market consistent embedded value. And you know all about solvency too. Doesn't help you here because you've got to find a job here. Returning to Australia, probably in the wrong order. So the problem is the person sitting next to you when you leave keeps steadily going up, and you know you were smart enough to actually probably stay a little bit ahead of them maybe. You go up here because you get a great job overseas, even go higher. Returning to Australia can be very difficult because the things you learn overseas are not 100% replaceable here in Australia. And you've got to convince people that market consistent embedded value is relatively similar to embedded value here, and Solvency II is a bit like LAGIC and ICAP. US GAAP's nothing like IFRS, but I really do know IFRS as well. Or the skills I learnt, the negotiation skills, the leadership skills, all those sort of skills that you know are really relevant here. You're a bit behind the times in Australia, and returning to Australia and finding a job in Australia can be extremely difficult. Okay, so you've got this career trajectory which booms when you go overseas. If you get the right job, you can be having great jobs. I mean, I was regional CFO at Winter to Life in Hong Kong. Winter to Life was part of the Credit Suisse group, and now I'm actuarial controller at MLC. I mean, you put those on a piece of paper, you think, well, that was 8 years ago. I was regional CFO at Winter to Life. Now I'm actuarial controller at MLC. On a piece of paper, I'm quite happy. I love my job, and etc. Don't get me wrong. But 8 years ago, I was regional CFO at Winter to Life. I was living in a $10,000 a month apartment. I was driving a BMW 530 to the office. I had my school fees paid for me. I had my maid paid for me. I had my electricity and telephone paid for me. I worked on the 63rd floor of an office building in Wanshire. I had a chauffeur-driven Mercedes-Benz to take me to the airport to fly business class to places like Japan, Taiwan, Indonesia, China. I sat in Chinese tea ceremonies with very important dignitaries in China. It was brilliant. And now I'm back here being actuarial controller at MLC. I love it, by the way. I love it, by the way, but your career trajectory can take off, and you've got to be prepared when you come back to Australia to come back to reality. We skipped over conflicts of interest. This is a difficult one without... In certain markets, you're going to have very important positions. You're going to be a very important actuary, or very important, in my case, CFO, in some fairly important and in developing markets. Some of the things you see, you may not agree with. Some of the things you see being done would probably put people in jail in some more developed markets. And you've got to balance that. You've got to balance the conflicts of interest. We mentioned before these people on expat contracts with electricity paid for them. I was, I believe, quite fair. When I was as an expat, I'd turn my electricity off. I'd keep my air conditioning at 24 degrees. I'd sleep under a sheet at night, not a doona. I had colleagues who were not Australian. I won't belittle their nationalities, who felt they wanted the air conditioning at 16 degrees because they liked sleeping under a doona. They liked the thought of a doona. And they kept their air conditioning on in their house the whole day. So in Jakarta, I remember I had staff $100 a month salary. These people had electricity bills of probably $1,200 to $1,300 a month. And these $100 staff that I had, I was CFO in Indonesia, were paying their bills. How do you think they felt? $100 a month you're getting paid, and you're paying some goose $1,200 or $1,300 a month electricity bill. It's a conflict of interest. I tried to bring it up, and I got hammered for it. Mind your own business, Peter. Part of my deal, I can spend as much electricity as I want. I said, you're not being fair. In my contract, I can use as much electricity as I want. Go away. Hey, it's a conflict of interest. Again, I'm trying to do the best for people. So conflict of interest, much more prevalent over there. You'll find yourself in much more situations where you have to take a moral stance, and that can be quite difficult. Particularly if you have the financial rewards. Are you going to walk away from that $250,000 tax-free job with the car and the house and the schooling and the maid and the pool boy and the gardener? It can be difficult. Another issue, returning to Australia is boring your friends. You have so many stories. And I could talk for hours about my stories. I was overseas for 10 years. I could probably talk for 25 years about my stories because I embellish them a little bit. But you do run the risk of boring your friends with your stories, which is one of the things when you're overseas, you're in the expat communities, you are talking to a fellow expat and you're on the same level and you're all just having a good time, basically. Work hard, play hard. It's good fun. Leave you the Nike expression, you know, if you get the chance, just do it. And that's it. Okay, so we've got about... I think we're up till 7, is that right, Joe? You've got 25 minutes. If people have any questions, would like any thoughts of my experiences, would like just make some statements about their own experiences. Has anyone here worked overseas yet? At all? No? Anyone really keen to work overseas? Like some names of some headhunters? I've got lots of headhunters that I could introduce you to. Okay, any questions?
Thanks for the talk, Peter. My question's more around kind of contrast the differences between, say, Europe and the UK versus Asia, because in your talk you mainly kind of talk in the context of Asia rather than Europe, UK, and just kind of what the main differences would have been and kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly of the UK and Europe.
Okay. It may have come across in discussion. I love Asia. I love Asian culture. I think the developing aspects in Asia are much more interesting. My time when I worked in the UK was my first overseas assignment. I think the UK is very similar to Australia in a lot of respects. It probably more depends on the job. You know, I spend a lot of time in Switzerland. I work for two Swiss companies there, so a lot of trips there and talking to the people there. It's, I guess, it's a lot more developed in the UK and Europe, therefore a lot less innovation. And I like seeing innovation and different things. So in terms of the work, I find the work more interesting in Asia. In terms of the culture, I find the culture more interesting in Asia. Travel opportunities, probably similar. I mean, it was great. I did a lot of travelling when I was in the UK, to Europe, and did a lot of travelling when I was in Asia, obviously. So, yeah, it's hard. It's like saying, what's better, Melbourne or Sydney at the time? It's very, very difficult to say. It's probably, yeah, I'll probably leave it there rather than dig a bigger hole. At the front here as well, the lady probably... Eunice can't probably see.
Thanks for your insight, Peter. My question is, you've done, you're an institute of the Actuary Institute, I mean a fellow, rather, and you've done your CPA as well. How did that fit in with all your travels? And when do you recommend that people, or when do you recommend to travel with respect to your studies?
That's a good question. I did my last... exam for my FIAA when I was in the UK in 1989. I did my CPA in Hong Kong, and I did my sort of bridging course from university where I'd done second year accounting to sort of the equivalent of university accounting when I was in Singapore. I'll start with the first question, which if I interpret a little bit, I believe many more actuaries should also be CPAs. I think there is a lot of synergies between accounting and actuarial in terms of things like capital, asset valuation, tax, and issues like that. Issues of, what's the word for it? When things get into the accounts and when they don't. Now, for example, my classic example is if you've got five claims which are being subject to litigation at the moment, and each claim you think has got a 20% chance of succeeding, the actuary in you would go 5 times 20%, let's reserve for one claim. The accountant says each claim has a 20% chance, which is unlikely. Therefore, nothing gets into our accounts as a liability for those claims. However, they do get into the accounts, in the notes to the accounts, as a contingent liability. But you've got to know that. You're going to have a discussion with the accountants about that. You should know that. That's how it works. We want to talk about deferred tax assets and the realisation of deferred tax assets and whether you should discount them or not discount them. Talk to the accountants. You want to talk about a business valuation and how you visit value an intangible asset such as a distribution agreement. Talk to the accountants, read AASA 1038 or whatever it is. But you've got to know that. So I believe CPA or CA and actuarial, there's a lot of synergies there. And when you become fellows, or if you are fellows, certainly consider it. There's a good program called the Pathways Program, which lets you do about 5 or 6 very simple exams and then do the CPA professional exams. By the way, much easier than the Institute of Actuaries exams, or Actuaries Institute exams. Yeah, I did them when I was in Hong Kong. I had done a little bit of accounting at university. My now ex-wife was an accountant, and I found the exams quite easy and straightforward. This is when I was CFO at Winter to Life, so it was very relevant to my work, and gives me a lot of credibility when I talk about CFO-type issues. So I wouldn't let the study get in the way of your travel. You've got those long aeroplane rides where you can do your study. You've got, So I would, I'd do both at the same time.
You spoke a bit about the difficulty in transferring the technical skills you gain overseas back to work in Australia, but how much importance... how important would employers here perceive the softer skills that you'd gain, such as, you know, project management and negotiation skills?
It's a good question because, in theory, they should value those skills greatly, and in theory, your HR and P&C people will tell you those skills, and the recruiting companies will tell you that's what you put at the top of the CV, not what you actually did. You don't put your technical skills there, you put your softer skills there. In my experience in practice, they discount all that. They don't know that you led a team of 70 when you're in Indonesia. Doesn't really matter. You know, have you led a team of 5 in Australia type thing. In theory, and I think maybe it's changing, but in my experience when I came back to Australia 6 years ago now, I felt I was behind the times. I felt my skills and my experiences overseas were devalued more than they should be by the people that interviewed me. It may have been the actual people. You're talking 4 or 5 people. You're talking 6 years ago. Yeah, in theory, they shouldn't be. In theory, we should all be looking at our CVs every year, trying to add something to them. This year I learned about project management. This year I learned a technical skill. This year I learned some leadership skills by leading the organisation. This year I talked to the board or I talked to the regulators. You know, think about adding to your CV every year. And I certainly did that, but when I got back I felt that my overseas experience was devalued, even the softer skills.
Hi, I'm not sure if this is your area of expertise, but do you have any information you could possibly share about what the actuarial job market is like in Latin America?
That's a bit off the wall. No, not in Latin America. Though I do know you can live in, is it Argentina, where you can ski in the morning and go to the beach in the afternoon? Because the mountains are so close to the beach.
Yeah, but what about work?
Oh, I don't know about work.
Okay.
No, I know very little about the current job market there. I do know when I was working for MetLife here in Australia, they were very bullish on South America. I think language, as I understand it, is probably more important in South America than in Asia. So if you speak your Spanish or your Portuguese, you're probably better equipped there. Most parts of Asia you can get away with English, but my understanding in South America it's a little bit more difficult. But yeah, I'd talk to a professional about that.
What was your main reason for decision to come back to Australia?
It's like most things, never one decision or never one, I guess, issue. As I alluded to before, I had an ex-wife. My children were back here in Australia. I wanted to spend some time with them while they were growing up. I'd been overseas for 10 years and thought it was just time to come back. Bought my first lawnmower when I came back, ever. So, yeah, it just felt like it was the time. And, yeah, I probably regretted it as well, regretted the decision to come back. Maybe I should have stayed there. You can't tell. You've got to make decisions and live with them all the time in your life.
I just had a question. Since you're being so honest, what was the funniest thing or craziest thing that happened overseas?
Oh, I need a few more beers to tell you the real stories. Funniest thing or craziest thing? Okay, here's one which never happened in Australia. In Indonesia, obviously $100 a month people employed by me, we had, I had a driver, my wife had a driver, we had a maid, we had a part-time maid, we had a pool boy, we had a gardening boy. We're keeping the economy afloat. we went away for a weekend and living in a compound, so sort of think townhouses, but slightly bigger, about 15 of them. We got back there and on a Sunday night, everything seemed fine. On a Monday, the maid from across the sort of little laneway in the compound came to my wife and said, "Did you realise that your driver and your maid spent the weekend together in your house?" So one of our drivers and one of our full-time maid were, let's say, in a relationship in our house over the weekend when we were, I think we went to Singapore that weekend. And you just think, okay, what, you know, where did they end up sleeping the night, etc. I mean, they were adults. One of them was married, one of them was not married, but that's their life. But yeah, that's a funny story. Was that funny enough, or is that too serious? Okay. Oh, you want something funnier? Funny.
More crazy as well.
Okay. Got another one for you. Okay. This is when I was working in Hong Kong, and we had a person over from. It's worth working for Manulife. We had a person from Manulife Canada who was on a short-term secondment to us, and we had this. And she was working with me in Hong Kong, and we had one of the just chief actuary from Canada came over, and they were in a meeting, and he asked her who she was, and she was actually one of his staff on our secondment. So he didn't realise that she actually worked for him, like directly for him. He didn't recognise her and didn't remember that she was on secondment to Hong Kong. Is that funny? Okay. Yes, Joe.
Yeah, so I understand you've been in life insurance for a long time, and at any point have you thought about moving away? If yes, at what point, and what were some of the challenges you faced when you wanted to make the move?
I have thought about moving away from life insurance. Moving away from life insurance is a bit like moving away from actuarial. You're paid a premium for your actuarial skills, so if you want to become something else, a barista, you're not going to get paid as much. So if I try and move from life insurance to somewhere else, I was very close to actually becoming CFO of a property developing company when I came back to Australia 6 years ago. I went for a few job interviews, met the chairman of the board, actually physically got told I had the job, and then got pulled from under me. So yeah, I've tried. It is difficult, and it depends on the job market. So. And when the job market's very buoyant, people take a punt. They take someone from Coca-Cola, who's a financial controller of Coca-Cola, and make them a financial controller in a life insurance company. At the moment, it's very difficult because the number of candidates looking for roles is enormous, and the quality is very good. And, like when you go for roles here in Australia, you are up against some very good candidates, and you shouldn't feel too ashamed and disappointed, when or if you miss out on roles. There are some good candidates out there. And most importantly, there's some very relevant candidates out there if you try and take a big leap to a completely different industry.
Hi, Peter. You mentioned Switzerland before. I was wondering if you could please elaborate on your experiences there.
Taxis are very expensive. Coca-Cola is very expensive. In fact, most things are very expensive in Switzerland. I worked for Swiss Re in Singapore for 5 years. I worked for Swiss Re in South Africa for about 14 months. And I worked for Winter to Life in Hong Kong for 18 months. So each of those roles, we used to have big get-togethers back in head office in Switzerland, generally Zurich, but sometimes other more exotic destinations there. I find that the Swiss... very easy to work for. I think there's a lot more synergies working for the Swiss than there are for the Americans. I find the Americans actually quite difficult to work for. I had one staff member from Singapore went and moved to Switzerland. Jessica, she did very well there. She really enjoyed it. I find the Europeans much more welcoming in terms of they're very used to different people and different cultures and different languages. So they are more welcoming. They are very strangely both open and reserved at the same time. So they're very honest with you. They'll talk straight to you. They won't get particularly excitable. But when you do a bad job, they'll tell you. So yeah, I'm very, very fond of the Swiss, and if you got to work in Switzerland, that would be brilliant, I think. Particularly if you like skiing. Oh, here's a funny story. One of the guys I worked with at Winter to Life was an ex-professional cyclist. Very apt, given that Green Edge is doing quite well at the moment, if you follow the cycling. Green Edge is the Australian cycling team. He tells a story of going for a bike ride in Switzerland, and he had his plastic container, his bidon of water, and he went for a drink about half hour into the ride, and it was frozen. It's so cold that his bidon had frozen. I find it quite fascinating. Because he's just so dedicated to his sport that he'd go out in, you know, basically sub-zero degrees temperatures and his water would freeze. So he didn't put antifreeze in there. Okay, yeah.
Hi. I was just wondering, you mentioned that sometimes it's very difficult coming back to Australia from a career perspective. I was just wondering what proportion of people don't make the decision to come back to Australia and what life is like for them.
Okay, I've had many friends that have followed the same path as me, gone overseas, come back to Australia. I have many friends that are still over there. Some of them doing very, very well. One of them's like a partner of Deloitte in Hong Kong, doing extremely well for himself. Others are perhaps still overseas because there's nothing for them back here. They know about, you know, direct sales force and direct sales force remuneration and particular Asian products, for example. And you know, to be fair, I think they're probably struggling. You know, they've still got roles, but I'm not too sure that they're living the lifestyle they were living before. So it is mixed. You know, some people are extremely successful and manage to secure bigger and bigger roles overseas and bigger and bigger challenges. You know, other people. Particularly if you don't stay relevant. And as a career guidance, I'd say keep your skills relevant. That's what I've tried to do. That's why I've tried to stay a professional, to Joe's earlier thing, and stay, you know, my FIAA and my FCPA and stay relevant and up to date. So if you don't do that, you know, you get to your, you know, 40s, 50s, you're going to struggle. You're going to struggle here in Australia at times as well. There'll be younger people, more enthusiastic people, more up-to-date people, people that'll say, why don't we sell insurance on the smartphone? Why don't we use video, you know, chat to the help desk and things like that? And you know, so you've got to stay relevant. You stay relevant, you can have a brilliant career overseas and stay there your entire life and retire there. If you don't stay relevant, it's the same story in Australia, you can be sidelined. So,
Hi, Peter. Just wondering, is there anything that you reckon that Aussie actuaries are well known for or do better than actuaries from other places? And is there anything that, you know, us as Aussie actuaries can learn from other places?
I think the Australian actuaries are noted for being practical and pragmatic. A lot of the Europeans that call themselves actuaries are sort of pure mathematicians. A lot of the American actuaries lack a bit of intuition, I believe. So the Australian actuaries, the South African actuaries, and Malaysian actuaries, surprisingly, are probably up there, as in my mind, the better actuaries in terms of being pragmatic, being able to make decisions, being able to communicate. Obviously, the Actuaries Institute is very big on communication, which is what you have to do there. So, yeah, I think, you know, we have a very good reputation there. probably literally hundreds of Australian actuaries working over there, and I do think the qualification does give you an advantage over some of the other worldwide qualifications. Time for one more question.
Thank you. And I don't have a question. I just want to help with one of the questions about Latin America. I'm Brazilian, and I have six years experience in Brazil. And the Brazilian economy now is really strong, so you're going to have good job there and good payments. If you want to live there, if you want to come back, you're going to have a problem if the currency is 2-for-1. All my money gone because of this. And the market there is traditional, so we have more than 0.5% of actuaries work with pension funds and other 30% work with insurance, life insurance. So you have great opportunities in reinsurance because the market is open 5 years ago. It was just one public company. And they open now. You're gonna have problem with culture in São Paulo. I'm from São Paulo. In São Paulo, we have 25 million people, so you can walk with your iPhone and use your iPad in the buses like here. And but about the culture, you're gonna enjoy a lot because to enjoy Brazil is the best place. Yeah, a lot of parties and yeah. And yes, yeah, it's a good experience. And Brazil is growing. I don't know about Argentina or Chile. The other countries are really poor, like Paraguay and yeah. But it's good. It's a good experience.
Any one more question? We just entertain one more. No? Okay, yeah.
Just a quick question. When you went overseas for the first time to work, was that more a gamble to go from one company to another, or was that an internal move that you took? And if it was internal, how exactly did you go and propose that to your manager to suggest that you would be worthwhile to invest in them? To go and work overseas.
Okay. My first move was to go and work in the UK, and it was an internal transfer, and it was my boss that came to me and asked me if I wanted to go. So I was very, very blessed. He himself had worked before in Toronto and the Caribbean, and was very big on international transfers. So yeah, I was very blessed, and thank you. Mark Gallagher was his name. I always thank him because that gave me the first taste of it, and I was very blessed with that. My second transfer was actually my second time overseas was with the same company, but I'd left it by then. But they'd come back looking for me. They wanted an actuary to help them in Singapore, and they came and found me when I was working at Tillinghast. So again, it wasn't me actually pushing it. Asking for it, it was they came to me, but it didn't take me long to say yes, please. So it was easy for me. It's a lot harder when you're not asked to do it and you've got to go and find the role. But I wish you all the best for doing that. Just do it.
Well, I want to thank Peter, for presenting. So one thing I've gotten from this whole, presentation, it looks like I'm going to be packing my bags and going to Brazil soon. I want a free maid.
He's a salesman, isn't he? I want
to go. Yep. So, and thanks a lot, Peter, for coming, sharing with us. And I hope all you guys enjoyed the night. And we'll keep you posted on our next YAP event. And, it's a great turnout. If you got any questions, shoot us an email and always keep an eye on the website and on our posters. And thanks a lot for coming.